Before we get into the topic itself of Hanukkah, it's important to hear the following two introductions to the topic. The first one is connected to the Sedra this week, Vayeshev, and that is the following. The Gemara in Shabbos says, Near Hanukkah, Shehinicha Lamala Mi Esrim Ama Psula. If you have a Near Hanukkah and it's higher than 20 Amas, about 40 feet above ground level, you don't fulfill the mitzvah. Right after that, the Gemara quotes something else from the same Tana, that Habor Reik Ein Bo Mayim, says in this week's Sedra, that when they threw Yosef into the pit was empty without water. So the Gemara says it didn't have water in it, but it had snakes and scorpions, poisonous snakes and scorpions in it. The question is, what do these two things have to do together that the Gemara quoted both of them together? So there are many different explanations. I think I want to explain it in the following way. When someone falls into a pit with snakes and scorpions, poisonous snakes and scorpions, the Gemara says that one who sees someone fall into such a pit knows that there are poisonous snakes and scorpions in it, but doesn't see what happened to the person. He can assume for sure that the person has been killed, and he can go and testify that his wife can remarry. Why? Because even though sometimes snakes and scorpions do not attack a person, but when somebody falls on them, they don't take too kindly to that and they attack back. So the fact that Yosef fell into a pit with snakes and scorpions and was not killed was an open miracle. Now we know that there is a mitzvah to publicize miracles. So why didn't the Torah say clearly, a great miracle happened here? Yosef was thrown into a pit with snakes and scorpions and survived. Why did the Torah only hint to it in a very obscure hint to tell me that the pit was empty of water, and I'm supposed to derive from that that it wasn't empty of snakes and scorpions? Why didn't the Torah publicize this miracle? The answer, I think, is that publicizing miracles, the purpose of it is not to let me know that God can do a good trick. Because whatever it is, God can do better. What are you going to tell me? God could save Joseph from snakes and scorpions. Big deal. God can create people. He can create snakes and scorpions. What's the big deal that he can save people from them? God can make oil burn 8 days. Big deal. He can make the oil. He can make water burn. What is the big deal? So the idea is not to publicize that God can do tricks. So what is the purpose? Because sometimes God has to attract our attention to something, a message that he wants to give us. And in order to attract our attention, he does it in a way that is miraculous. Therefore, the whole purpose of publicizing the miracle is to learn the lesson. And therefore, a miracle that no one learned anything from, because either the brothers didn't know there were snakes and scorpions, or they didn't take it to heart. No one learned anything from this miracle, therefore there's no idea of publicizing it. And that's the same thing with Ner Chanukah. If you want to fulfill the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, of publicizing the miracle by seeing the menorah, it has to be within your line of vision. So you can think about it and ponder, what is it supposed to teach me? What am I supposed to learn from this? But if it's higher than 20 amos, you can see it, but you only look up every once in a while and you're impressed by the miracle, but it's not something within your line of vision that you can think about and think about the message. And where you don't learn the message from the miracle, there's no idea to publicize it, just to tell me that God can do a good trick. So therefore, the discussion of Hanukkah is going to have to be, what is the message of Hanukkah? What are we supposed to learn from that? What is the ongoing message that these miracles tell us? Second preface, give you a marshal. Imagine someone walking down the street, minding his own business, and someone comes with an iron pole and breaks both his legs. Now he's writhing in pain on the sidewalk, and the man with the iron pole comes over him and says, "I mean you no harm. I'm an orthopedic surgeon who needs practice. So I broke your legs. I'm going to take you to my clinic. I'm going to set your legs and heal you. And in 6 months, you're going to be walking like nothing ever happened. And I'm not going to charge you a penny." How much of a thank you does he owe that orthopedic surgeon? Zero. He owes him a lawsuit for breaking his legs. If you didn't break my legs, you wouldn't have to heal me. So why should I thank you? If that's the case, we believe that everything that happens in this world happens because God allows it to happen or wants it to happen. And therefore, who got us into the predicament of Greece, of Yavon? God. Who took us out of the predicament? God. Why do I have to thank him? Don't let the Greeks put me into a tzara and don't redeem me. Right? You broke my legs, you healed me. Why do I owe you any thanks? So why do we celebrate Hanukkah? God is the one who permitted the Greeks to make their terrible decrees against us and all the terrible things they did to us. And he's the one who saved us. Don't break my legs and don't save me. Don't put me into this predicament. Don't take me out. So why do we celebrate Hanukkah? Now, the purpose of this shiur is not to convince you not to celebrate Hanukkah this year. So there must be an answer. The answer is that my marshal is not a good marshal. And it would be proper the following way. Imagine a disease of the legs, which I made up. And I have a right to make up any marshal I want. That was part of my contract with the OU. So I can even make up diseases. The disease has the following pathology. It incubates in the bones of your leg for 10 years, and you don't even know you have it. Only an expert in this disease can tell from the way a person's walking that he has the disease. Exactly to the second of 10 years, it causes the bones of the leg to disintegrate. And from that point on, there's no cure. The person is going to be a cripple for the rest of his life. There's only one cure to this disease. If you catch it before the 10 years and you break the person's legs and you reset the bones, they'll grow back healthy and normal. It's the only cure. Now let's go back to the guy walking down the street, minding his own business. Behind him is an orthopedic surgeon who is an expert in this disease and sees from the way that he's walking that he has the disease, and there's 5 minutes left until the 10 years are up. What does he have to do? Find an iron pole, break the guy's legs pronto, and then tell him you're a lucky man. He says, "Why am I a lucky man with two broken legs?" He says, "Because in 5 minutes, had I not broken your legs, you'd be a cripple for life. Because I broke your legs, I'm going to take you to my clinic. I'm going to reset the bones. And in 6 months, you're going to be walking like nothing ever happened." Now does he owe him a thank you? Of course. Not only does he owe him a thank you for healing him, he owes him a thank you for breaking the legs, because that was part of the process of the healing. Sometimes we do things as a nation that make us sick spiritually. And God knows that the only cure for that sickness is to break our legs and then to reset them, to bring us into some tzara, some predicament, and then to take us out of it. That's all part of the process, the healing process. And if God had done nothing, had he not permitted this sorrow to come, things would have been much worse. Now we can discuss, and therefore, when a person is saved from a tzara, the Shari Tshuva says, he should thank God not only for the salvation, but for the tzara itself. Because if you don't appreciate that the tzara was necessary as part of the healing process, then why should you thank God for saving you if he could have prevented you from being in the predicament to begin with? And that's the word nes. Nes is comprised of two letters, nun and samech. Nun, the Gemara says, hints to nefila, falling. And samech is supporting one who falls. So the nes, which usually happens when there's a tzara and we're safe from it, hints to both things. We have to thank God for the fall and for the support afterwards. So in our discussion of Hanukkah, we're going to have to not only understand the message of the redemption and the miracles, but why it was necessary for us to go through the tzara of Yavan, the tzara of Greece, and all their decrees. So now let's start the topic. It says in the Alanisim of Purim, which is parallel to the Alanisim of Hanukkah, one difference. How does the Alanisim of Purim start? Bimei Mordechai ve'Esther b'Shushan Habira. It introduces the period of time that we're talking about and who the tzaddikim were, similar to the Alanisim of Hanukkah. Bimei Matisyo ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol Chashmonayu Vanov. Then the time of the Kohen Gadol, of the Beis HaMikdash, and who the tzaddikim were. Okay, now that we introduced the tzaddikim, let's find out who the wicked people were. Kishomer Aleim Homan Arasha. Similar to Kishom the Malchus Yovan HaRishah Alam Cho Yisrael. Now that we know who the tzaddikim were and who the Rishayim were, what was the problem? So by Purim it says, Bikesh Lahashmid Laharogul Abed. He wanted to annihilate us. What should be the next word by the Alanisim of Hanukkah? Bikshu Lashkicham Torasecha. They wanted to make us forget the Torah. But that word, Bikshu, is missing. It doesn't say they wanted to make us forget the Torah. It just says, Lahashkicham Torasecha, to forget the Torah. It doesn't say what the Greeks wanted to do to us. It just says what the result was. I think the answer is the problem of Purim did not start until Haman actively did something against us and he decided to annihilate us. That began the Tzara. By Yavan, the Tzara didn't start when they made their decrees against us. It started way before that. When Yavan emerged as a world power, as an empire, that in itself was a danger to the Jewish people. They didn't have to seek to do anything against us. They didn't have to make any decrees. Just their emergence as a world empire was a threat to the Jewish people. How so? First of all, let's see that that's true. Because before the Greeks made any decrees against us, there were Jews who were influenced by Greek culture and gave up Yiddishkeit and became Hellenists, Mishyavnim. So we see that the danger to the Jewish people was not caused by what the Greeks wanted to do, but what they were. Different than Purim, where the danger was what Haman wanted to do, not necessarily what he was. So now, what was the danger? What was so dangerous about Greek civilization or Greek culture that it affected so many Jews in a negative way? Basically, the Greeks came from Yefes. Let's go back in history a little bit. Very much at the beginning of the world after the flood, the world came through three sons of Noah, Shem, Cham, and Yefes. The Maralmi Prague explains that the three aspects of society were represented by these three sons. The world needs a physical plant. Yefes was to produce the physical plant of the world, the body of the world. Shem was to introduce into that physical plant spirituality, inner spirituality, just like the body. The body's a physical thing, and the soul introduced into the body introduces spirituality into that body. So Yefes was going to create the body of civilization, and Shame was to inject it with holiness. You have a body and you have a soul, you need energy and drives to move it. That was Cham. Cham means heat, energy. So the drives and the energy to move the soul and the body, that was would come from Cham. And therefore, Noah said the following, Yaft Elokim leYefes, veYishkol beOl Eshem. Yefes should be increased and beautified, the physical plant of the world, but he should partner with Shem and work together, the soul and the body together. Because a body without a soul is dead, and a soul without a body can't exist in this world. So they have to work together. And they should rule over Cham. Cham is a slave to the body and the soul, meaning the drives that drive a person, the appetites that drive a person, have to be subjugated to the body and the soul, because if they are not, they can destroy the body and the soul by indulging in these appetites in a way that is dangerous to the body and the soul. So the drives, the Cham, the heat, the energy, has to be subjugated to the body and the soul. Had Yefes fulfilled his purpose and partnered with Shem, and they would produce the physical externals of the world, and Shem would introduce the inner spiritual values, that would have been perfect. But Yefes, and the main descendant of Yefes was Yavan, was Greece. They decided that they don't believe in any inner value to this world, any spiritual value. They only believe in the externals. And they deified external might, external beauty, even when it came to wisdom. They only accepted external wisdom, chokhma chitzonis, what you can come to with your own logic and your own brain. No, they didn't believe in any revealed wisdom that was beyond the external wisdom that a person could come to on his own. In fact, even the gods of the Greeks were basically supermen and superwomen. They were not spiritual figures. They were just super physical figures that they deified. So the Greeks believed only in the externals of the world, the physical world, and not at all accepted any inner spiritual value in this world. And I think the name Yavan hints to that. Yavan is comprised of three letters, Yud, Vav, and Nun. Those three letters are lines that have no inside. All they have is a line, an external line. So Yavan is composed of three external lines, but there's more than that. When you look at the world from a physical standpoint, you measure it in amount, in quantity. When you look at the world in a spiritual aspect, you measure it in quality, not in quantity. You can't quantify spirituality. In the physical world of quantity, there are three generic quantities, small, medium, large. That's Yavan. Three lines with no inside, a small yud, a medium-sized vav, and a large nun. Small, medium, and large. That's the physical world. In addition, these three lines are parallel. They never meet. From a physical standpoint, everything is separate. Everything has its parameters. Only spiritual things can create achdus and unity. So Yavan is represented by three lines that have no inside, that come in the three generic sizes of small, medium, and large, and there's no connection between them. There's no achdus. Everything is separate. That is Yavan. In addition, The word Yavan, if you spell it backwards, is noi, beauty. They took what real beauty is and they made it into something external only and turned it topsy-turvy, upside down. So that's what Yavan represented, a totally physical, external view of the world. And they created a very impressive physical external society. Beauty, wisdom, all external. Now, Jews of the time, many of them were weak in service of Hashem. What does that mean? The service in the Beis Hamikdash represented the inner values of Judaism. There's two ways of approaching Yiddishkeit. A person can look at Judaism as just a bunch of do's and don'ts. Torah is like a game, do this, don't do that. But they don't understand the inner value of those mitzvahs, that they're supposed to mold your personality, supposed to mold your way of life, and create an inner holiness of what Jewish life is. So they see the externals of Torah, the do's and the don'ts, but they don't take it beyond that to see that those do's and don'ts are supposed to create a way of life, Torah personality, right? An environment of Torah. The Jews that understood that Torah is more than just a bunch of external commands, but it's a way of life, were not affected by the external beauty and power of Greece. But the Jews that looked at the Torah from a totally external way, they kept the mitzvahs, but they kept them totally as just a bunch of do's and don'ts, but didn't realize that there's something more beneath that, a Torah way of life. So when you try to compare the externals of Torah to the externals of Greece win out because they're stronger and more beautiful than the externals of Torah. But, and these people were influenced and attracted to Greek culture. And eventually many of them gave up the Torah and became Hellenists. The Jews that appreciated the inner value of Torah, the Torah way of life, the beauty of a Torah personality, the inner idea, so excuse the pun, but the externals of Greece can't hold a candle to the internal values of Torah. They weren't affected. Now, the Chafetz Chaim says in general a rule that when people do not appreciate what they have, the Rebbe Mishlam sometimes brings either Goyim or other Tzoros to threaten to take it away from them, or actually takes it away from them. And the nature of human beings is when you have something, you take it for granted. When it's no longer there or somebody wants to take it from you, then you begin to appreciate it. So the Rebbe Mishlam permitted the Greeks, he didn't make them because they chose to do it for their evil reasons, but he didn't stop them from breaking our legs, because if nothing would have happened, then many, many Jews would have been lost to Judaism because of the influence of Greek culture. Why were they influenced? Because they didn't appreciate the inner values of Torah and a Jewish way of living, a Torah way of living. So the Rabbanu Shalom permitted the Greeks to make their decree specifically against the inner values of Torah. When the Greeks conquered a nation, they were set on world conquest. When they conquered a nation, they allowed the nations to have their own customs and their own folklore, but to only if they would lead a Greek way of life. Exactly how it would be, what are your customs, what are your folklores, fine, as long as the end product would be Greek culture. So they were willing to let the Jewish people keep a lot of the mitzvahs. That's their folk customs. And they were it was okay with them that we learned the written Torah, because that's our folklore. But what they were against was Lashkicham Torah Shechel. The Torah should not be an inner way of life that was different than the Greek way of life, and therefore they wanted us to forget the oral Torah. The written Torah is a bunch of stories with a bunch of customs and laws. It's not alive. What gives the Torah life? The oral Torah. That's why it's called the Mishnah. The same letters that make up Mishnah are the letters of Neshama. Written, the oral Torah is the Neshama. It is the soul of the written Torah. That's what they wanted us to forget. No oral Torah, because that makes the Torah a way of life, not just a bunch of customs and folklore. And they wanted us to basically la'avira mechukei ritzonecha. We could keep mitzvahs, but it shouldn't be the will of God that runs our life. It should just be a bunch of do's and don'ts. They wanted to transfer us from a Torah way of life to a Greek way of life. So that was basically the Greeks in the idea of decree, to make us forget and to suppress the inner values of Torah. And like we said, God permitted that because that was breaking our legs in order to heal us. Because what was the sickness? That we didn't appreciate the inner values of Torah. And by having the Greeks threaten to take those values away from us, all of a sudden we began to appreciate them. Because when you have something, you take it for granted. When it's threatened to be taken away or taken away, then you begin to appreciate it. So this was the process of breaking our legs to make us appreciate what we didn't appreciate and were therefore vulnerable to the influence of Greek civilization. Now let's see what the decrees were and how the Greeks wanted to accomplish that. You're familiar with the three major decrees that the Greeks made: Shabbos, Bris Milah, and Rosh Chodesh. They wanted to suppress those mitzvahs. The Rambam, and we said also, they wanted to suppress the oral Torah, which was the neshama, the inner value, and made Torah a way of life. There were two other decrees which the Greeks made, which the Rambam mentions, based on various midrashim. They also made decrees against Jewish money and Jewish women. And now I'll describe why God permitted them to do this, to break our legs in the process of healing us from not appreciating the inner value of Torah. Shabbos is the soul of the physical world. The physical world created in 6 days is the body. But what introduces a spiritual soul to that body is Shabbos, which is like Olam Haba. So Shabbos is the neshama of the physical world. Bris Milah is a neshama of the body. The body is a physical thing. Bris Milah represents that that physical body has a connection to Hashem, has a neshama to it. There's a soul to the body. And Rosh Chodesh is the soul of time. Time is also an external entity. But you can introduce holiness and Kedusha into time. As we say, Mekadesh Yisrael Vazmanim. When do we sanctify time? And all of the Yamin Tovim come from that sanctification when we sanctify the new moon. So we introduce Kedusha, holiness, into time. So Rosh Chodesh is the soul of time, Bris Milah is the soul of the body, and Shabbos is the soul of the physical world. And that's what they wanted to take away from us, the soul of Yiddishkeit. And when they made those gezeros to take it away, we began to appreciate what we didn't appreciate before, that inner value of Torah, which would give us the ability to withstand the influence of the externals of Greece. What are the other two decrees? Jewish money. They decreed that if any Jew owned any physical property, you owned a computer, you owned sheep, oxen, you had to engrave on them, Ein lanu chelik b'elokei Yisrael. We have no share in the God of Israel. Every material thing could only be held if you engraved on it that you have no connection to God. What's the idea? Money, from a secular standpoint, the body of the money itself is important. There are people who work themselves literally to death. They ignore their families in order to earn more and more money and to be rich people. The money itself is a value, and people sacrifice their lives for it. They never even enjoy it. They never even use it. Just to have more and more money is an external level of zara. From a Torah standpoint, money is very important. Chazal say, tzadikim chavivim aleim mamonam yosem migufan. A tzadik's money is more precious to him than his body. Why? Because a tzaddik realizes that his money was given to him as a means to serve Hashem. It's a vessel that can be used somehow in service of Hashem. And that's what gives it importance. Now, his body is also a vessel to be used in service of Hashem. For sure, the body is more important than the money, because if you don't have a body, you can't use your money. But it doesn't say that tzaddikim value their money more than their body. It says it's more precious to them. What makes something precious? What makes something precious is how much effort you put into it. The more effort you put into something, the more precious it is. How much effort do you have to put in securing your body and using it as a tool to serve Hashem? You don't have to put any effort into getting your body. It's a birthday present. Your first birthday, God gave you a present, he gave you a body. So you don't have to put any effort into that. You have to put effort into maintaining your body and using your body. How about money? Since tzaddikim don't steal, they have to earn every penny with a great amount of effort. So they have to put in a tremendous effort to get their money. And they have to put effort into maintaining their money and into using it. So out of three efforts, three apply to the money and only two apply to the body. And both of them, the tzaddik looks at as a means to serve Hashem. So which is more precious? The one you put more effort into, the money, rather than the body. But our understanding of money is it has no intrinsic external value. The value is made by how you use it. If you use it for important spiritual things, then it's important. If not, it's not important. From a Greek standpoint, money has no inner value. It's the money itself, the body of the money itself, that's important. So the Greeks wanted to decree, we don't want you to have a philosophy of money that is an internal idea. It's totally external. So you have to engrave on it, we have no share in the God of Israel. This money is not connected to godliness. It's just a physical thing that can make you powerful and rich or whatever. So they made the decree against Jewish money. And the last one is against Jewish women. They said that any woman who gets married before she lives with her husband had to have relations with the Greek officer of that area. And that took the inner holiness of marriage and reduced it to just physicality. And married women were not allowed to go to the mikveh. There was no taras ha-mishpacha. They prohibited mikvahs, that marriage should not have that purity about it. Those were basically the decrees of the Yevanim, and they all had one purpose: take away the inner value of Judaism, reduce it to a bunch of folklore and folk customs that was compatible with the Greek philosophy and the Greek way of life. And again, when Jews were threatened to have that inner values of Torah taken away, they began to appreciate what they didn't appreciate before. Now, why did they make decrees against women? because from a secular standpoint, even in this progressive and liberated world, women are still looked upon as external objects and judged on their external attributes. How do I know that? Because there are still Miss America and Miss Universe and Miss Israel pageants. And even though they claim that they have improved them and they have the women reading their poetry and speaking about their careers, it's all done in bathing suits, which has me believe that the careers and the poetry is not the icker. So women are basically external objects. From a Torah standpoint, women are the foundation of Jewish holiness. And I'm not saying that to make the women feel good. It's true. Because there is only one factor, if you're not a convert, one factor that determines whether you, anybody, has a holy Jewish soul or a regular non-Jewish soul. What is that factor? Who your mother was. Your father could have been Genghis Khan. But if your mother is a plain, simple Jewish, then you have a Jewish soul. And your father could have been Moshe Rabbeinu. But if your mother is not Jewish, then you do not have a Jewish holy soul. So what is the factor, the only factor, that causes Jewish holiness to come into this world? Mothers. And until recently, mothers were women. And therefore, women are the foundation of Jewish holiness. So that's what the Greeks wanted to do. And therefore, we don't find that the Greeks wanted to destroy us. There's two words that are used by the Greeks. They didn't want to destroy the temple. They defiled the temple. They didn't destroy the menorah. They defiled the oil. Those are the two words that are used as to what the Greeks wanted to do. Letamei ulechaleil, to desecrate and to defile. Now, the Hebrew meaning of these words is the following. Lechaleil, which is translated to desecrate, means to hollow out, to take away any internal internal importance. How do I know that? The word halal means a dead body. He's hollow on the inside, his neshama left. Halal ha-shamayim is outer space, empty. A chalil is a flute because it's hollow on the inside. And I am pretty sure that the etymology of the word hollow comes from the word halal. Ches, lamed, lamed, H-O-L-L-O-W. Halal and hollow are very similar, especially if you're Russian and you say hollow, hollow, and not hollow, right? It's mamas the same word. So they wanted to empty us out from any internal values. And that's tumah. Wherever there was an inner kedusha and it left, like a person died, his neshama left him, the vacuum that's left is tuma, or it attracts tuma. That's how tuma comes. Wherever there was kedusha and the kedusha left, and the classical example is death, that's where tuma is. So the Yavanim wanted to hollow us out, take away any inner values, inner holiness, and leave only the shell, leave only the externals, because that was the hallmark of Greek society, Greek culture, Greek civilization, externals. Once the decrees took effect and they had their therapeutic value, the way the Rabbanu Shel Olam knew that if he broke our legs, he could reset them and we could be healed. So we began to appreciate those inner values of Torah. And then the Rabbanu Shel Olam aroused the Kohanim, not the physical leaders, not the soldiers, but the Kohanim, the spiritual leaders, and they were going to be able to go against the Greeks. And the Chashmonaim hint to the fact that they possessed all of the power to go against the Greeks' decrees. How so? Ches is Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh. They wanted the decree against Rosh Chodesh. The Chashmonaim had the Ches of Chodesh to go against them. Shin is Shabbos. They wanted to go against Shabbos. The Chashmonaim had that power of Shabbos to counteract them. Mem is Mila, right? Also Mammon, money, Mila, Mishnah, all the other three things that the Greeks wanted to go against. Nun is Nida. They wanted to decree against Taras HaMishpacha, and the Chashmonaim had the power to go against that. Aleph Eishes Ish, married women. They wanted to desecrate the Kiddush of marriage. The Chashmonaim had the ability to go against that. And the Yud is just Chashmonai, right? That's the idea, like Yerushalmi and Tel Avivi. The Yud is just to make it personal. Or the Yud is the Yud, the inner Yud of God's name. In any case, so the Chashmonaim had the power to go against the Greeks, and it also showed that that inner spiritual power, which was what the Kohanim were able to overpower the external power of Greece. And that's why in the Alanisim it says the following: Mosarta giborim biad chaloshim, v'rabim biad ma'atim, utmeim biad tahorim, urishoim biad tzadikim, v'zeidim biad oskei sorasecha. You hand it over the few in the hands of the many, and the weak in the strong in the hands of the weak, and the defiled in the hands of the pure, and the wicked in the hands of the righteous, and the zedim, the people who were terribly evil, in the hands of the people who were osik batorah. So it always bothered me. I understand it's a miracle if the weak and the few win over the powerful and the many. Because naturally, the powerful and the many win over the weak and the few. But what's the miracle that the righteous win over the wicked and the pure win over the defiled? Is there some kind of unwritten natural law that righteous people always lose, and if they win, it's a miracle? What's the miracle in that? I was thinking it means something different. We did not win because we were few and weak. We won despite the fact that we were few and weak. So why did we win? Because the Greeks had the physical edge, the external edge. They were mighty and they were many. But we had the spiritual edge. We were pure and righteous and involved in Torah. So when there became a conflict between the physical and the spiritual went out. That is the message of Hanukkah. The main thing in this world is not the externals. It's the internal holiness. That is what is the main factor in this world, not the externals. That's the message against Greece. And that is the miracle of the oil. It doesn't make a difference how much oil there is. It's not quantity, but it's quality. If it's pure, it can last as long as you need it. If it's not pure, you can have a ton, and it's worthless. And that is the miracle of the menorah. The message of the menorah in the Haftorah for Hanukkah, it says that the menorah represents lo b'choach v'lo b'chayil, lo b'chayil v'lo b'koach kim baruch yomar Hashem. It's not the external might and power that makes a difference. It's that inner spiritual a spirit of God that makes a difference in this world. How does the menorah represent that? The menorah is a beautiful physical kli, gold with ornaments, but its whole purpose is that you can bring out that flame. The whole menorah is only useful if it's used to bring out that spiritual flame. And that is exactly what we say when we sing Ma'os Sur. We stand by our candles and we sing of all these empires that had everything physical going for them. They were mighty and they had land and riches and power, and they don't exist anymore. They're in the history books. They're not standing by any candle singing about us. We're still around and we didn't have any of that. What did we have? Those candles, that spiritual power. And we're around and they're not. So what do you see? That it's the spiritual that outweighs the physical when there is a conflict. There doesn't have to be a conflict. But when there is, the spiritual is the main factor, not the physical. And that is why in the Al HaNisim of Hanukkah, the word Gadol is mentioned four times, and in the Al HaNisim of Purim, it's not mentioned even once. Kohen Gadol, Lasos, Olecho Asisa, Shem Gadol, L'Amcha Yisrael Asisa, Teshua Gedola, L'Hodos, L'Hale, L'Shimcha HaGadol. Why this obsession with the word Gadol? Because the Torah refers to Yefes, the ancestor of Yavan, as Gadol. They were big, powerful, Gadol. But that's not what really Gadol is. Greatness is not necessarily physical. It's spiritual. The Kohen Gadol. How did they choose the Kohen Gadol? Did they weigh and measure every Kohen? And the fattest, tallest Kohen was the Kohen Gadol? No, it had nothing to do with his physical size. I remember when I was just started in yeshiva in Cleveland after high school. So I grew up in Miami. I never saw a Gadol b'Yisrael. They didn't exist in Miami. So I spent my first Ben Azman in Sukkos in New York. So I told my friends, take me to see Rav Moshe Feinstein. I want to see a Gadol b'Yisrael. So they took me to the Lower East Side, and we're about a block away from Rav Moshe's yeshiva. And they say, you see that person a block away in the distance? That's Rav Moshe Feinstein. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein came up to my shoulder, maybe. He's a little guy. And I remember as a 17-year-old thinking to myself, my God, if those are the Gedolim, what do the Ketanim look like? So he wasn't a Gadol because he was a basketball player. He was a Gadol because of his inner greatness. That's our concept of Gadol, not externals, internals. That is what Hanukkah is all about. That is the message of Hanukkah. You want to know what the message of Hanukkah is? The message is when there doesn't have to be a conflict. The external and internal can work together beautifully. But when there's a conflict between them, don't be influenced by the greatness and grandeur of Greek culture, of the externals of the world, but realize that what you have, that internal value, is much more significant. And therefore, the result of the victory was that everything the Greeks wanted to take away from us, not only did we get it back, we got it back in an increased way. Every Hanukkah has 8 days, just like Bris Milah. Every Hanukkah has at least one Shabbos, sometimes two, and it's not just Shabbos, it's Shabbos Hanukkah. Every Hanukkah has Rosh Chodesh Teves, and it's not just Rosh Chodesh, but it's a Rosh Chodesh that we say a full Hallel because it's Hanukkah. It's an increased Rosh Chodesh. Every Hanukkah, we deal with money, Hanukkah Geld. And every Hanukkah, women have a special place that they don't do work when the candles are lit. So all the things that the Chashmonaim, that the Greeks wanted to take away from us, were given back to us in Hanukkah, that we appreciated them more. Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, Bris Milah, women and money. Those five things. In any case, just to end on a little lighter note, when I first came to Eretz Yisrael 38 years ago, there were a lot of things here that were culture shock between what things were like in Chutz Laaretz and the Israeli way of doing things. And those people who understand what I'm saying obviously did not grow up in Eretz Yisrael and understand this difference in culture between Israeli society and American English society. One of the things that was really a culture shock was Hanukkah. In Chutz Laaretz, in America, I assume in England, the same thing, South Africa, whatever, in Chutz Laaretz, the food of Hanukkah is latkes. Everybody agree? Latkes is Hanukkah. Hanukkah is latkes. Came to Israel, and I had my first Hanukkah party, Israeli Hanukkah party, and there wasn't one latke. What was the main focus of the party? Jelly donuts, sufganiyot. Now, jelly donuts are very nice for carnivals. What in the world's have to do with Hanukkah? So I was really shocked. So I figured maybe the host didn't know how to make latkes. Second day, another party, jelly donuts, no latkes. Third day, the same thing. Finally, on the fourth day of Hanukkah, I was driving together with an Israeli friend, and we passed by the army base near our moshav, Mitgan Adam. And there was a big billboard in front of the army base with an arrow pointing towards the army base and one word on the billboard, latkes. I said, wow, at least in the army, they have maintained the custom of eating latkes and they publicize it and tell you where to get them. My Israeli friend said to me, don't get excited. That does not say latkes. That says latekes to the, ceremony. Okay, in any case, but after thinking about it, the Israeli custom is much more significant to Hanukkah than the Chutz La'aretz. Why do we eat latkes on Hanukkah? Because they're made in oil. I'm sure, and they're not only made in oil, they're saturated in oil. I'm sure if you put a wick into a latke, it will last 8 weeks, not 8 days. So it reminds us of the miracle of the oil. Jelly donuts, you could say the same thing. They're fried in oil. So it reminds us of the miracle of the oil. But if there's another message of a jelly donut that doesn't apply to a latke, the jelly donut tells me it's not what's on the outside that's the main thing, it's what's on the inside. And that is the message of Hanukkah. The externals are not the main thing in this world. It's the internal spiritual kedusha that is the main thing, and that's represented by a jelly donut. So that is the message of Hanukkah. It says in the Alanisim, "La'amcha Yisrael asisa teshua gedola uforkon kayom hazeh." Till today, the message of Hanukkah, the victory of Hanukkah exists. What kind of victory? There's no more Beis HaMikdash. There's no more Greeks. So where is the victory? The victory is this message. We're given something that every year we can recharge our batteries with the message, don't be influenced and overwhelmed by the externals of this world. They are not the main thing. The main thing is that inner Kedusha. And that is the message of Hanukkah. And that's what we should take away when we celebrate Hanukkah, to remember that that is the case, not to be influenced and overwhelmed by Western culture and Greek culture, which emphasizes the externals of the world, but to remember the main power in this world is that inner spiritual power, which we have. We're still around. We're singing about those empires. They don't exist except in the history books. They're not singing about us. We have those candles that give us the ability to continue to exist. And in Yirtzeh Hashem, we'll see the end of those last empires, which are still around. The empire of Rome, Edom, and the empire of Yishmael, we'll see them also delegated to the history books, the Vias Kol Tzedek Meherav Yameinu.